Thanks for downloading our podcast. You can find out more about Tech Tent from our webpage. Go to bbcworldservice.com/techtent. Hello and welcome to Tech Tent, your weekly update on all the news and views from the technology industry. I'm Rory Catlin-Jones, and this week we look at the crisis facing social media moderation as the likes of Facebook come under pressure to police their platforms better. We'll hear why our attitudes to work need to change as the robots advance, and we'll try out a phone that is anything but smart. Joining me is the BBC technology reporter Samantha Smith. Hello, Samantha.
Hello, Rory.
First time in the tent. And my special guest this week is Claire McDonald from Computer Weekly. Welcome, Claire.
Hey, yo.
Good to have you here too. And here's a flavour of what's coming up. You're the first customer.
Yes, I am the first one.
For every minute of the day, the platform received 100 hours of video.
Human need and human capacity adapts and generates new ways to create value.
I believe in the KISS principle. Keep it simple, stupid.
We're not going to keep it all that simple, and because we know you're not stupid. But first today, now, at the G7 summit in Italy today, the British Prime Minister Theresa May has called for international pressure on social media firms to do more to remove extremist content. Also this week, we've seen The Guardian newspaper publish a leaked Facebook training manual for the people who moderate its site, with details on how they're supposed to handle sex, violence and extremist content. Two examples, then, of the huge challenge now facing social media firms and the people who act as moderators as they try to police their users. Professor Sarah Roberts of UCLA in California has carried out extensive research into this process of moderation. I asked her about the scale of the challenge faced by social media firms.
Social media platforms are reliant upon user-generated content to gain and keep users. And at the end of the day, these platforms are interested in delivering those users to advertisers. One way to cut in on the magnitude of this issue is to think about how much content is being produced. In 2014, YouTube released a statistic that said that for every minute of the day, the platform received 100 hours of video. That in itself is staggering, and that statistic is now a little bit stale. If we look at something like Facebook, they have billions of users. So the scope and magnitude of the issue, it can't really be underestimated.
Have they been, to be honest, rather lax in accepting their responsibilities to police their platforms?
I think you're spot on there, and I think there's a couple of reasons for that. This is really not a glamorous aspect to the business of social media. Platforms would rather spend their resources doing the kinds of things that they can tout that will lead to new users, developing new tools, creating new functionality. I think platforms are also not eager to discuss that because it really does ultimately implicate them in serving as an impetus for some of the very worst kinds of human behavior.
Are we reaching something of a crisis point for these social media firms? There's suddenly a lot of spotlight on them, particularly on Facebook.
This is a problem that pervades the industry. It's not just Facebook that is struggling with these issues, but Facebook does have a vast share of the global marketplace. I think the public is reaching a bit of a point of fatigue where it seems that the platforms have been operating to a certain extent with very little engagement with the public about what is actually going on those platforms.
We've had that glimpse in those leaked documents of what some of Facebook's policies are. Do they and other social media platforms need to be far more upfront? Don't they just need to publish that kind of stuff?
I've often found it curious that firms have not gone that route. You know, we must acknowledge here that these platforms have an origin point, not just within the United States, but in a very particular place, which is Silicon Valley. And that is a place that many may know has a certain kind of ethos and is steeped in a certain kind of belief system around technological solutions to everything, including social problems.
What you're saying is they believe that technology will solve all of these problems. They actually need to hire a lot more people and think a lot more deeply from a human level about what they're doing.
That's my diagnosis. And of course, I have my particular perspective, not just mine, but those of other people who are engaged in the social sciences and the history of computing and so on, actually would have a lot to offer to the conversation. We know that Facebook has greatly expanded its workforce in the area of commercial content moderation. It made a very unusual public announcement acknowledging the fact that it already had some 4,500 people working on these issues around the world. And it, in that press release, indicated that it would be adding another 3,000 people to that workforce, bringing it up to 7,500. But again, these are people who are at a policy implementation level. These aren't people they're bringing on to ask them to help think about some of these problems at a greater macro level. And I think at the register that Facebook could use some assistance.
That's Professor Sarah Roberts from UCLA in Los Angeles. My special guest, Claire McDonald from Computer Weekly. Being a moderator is a growth industry, isn't it? It sounds a pretty terrible job, doesn't it?
It sounds like something that I wouldn't want to have to take responsibility for, definitely.
But the industry here, this social media industry, they're creating thousands of jobs doing this because they're dealing with an ever-growing problem, aren't they?
They are. And the problem with it seems that there's a disconnect between the business aims and then what society actually needs from these platforms, because they have too much of an influence over what people think and how people make decisions to be seen not to be doing something. And as much as these processes could be automated to take rid of, to get rid of the human element.
Yeah, they seem to think that IT is the answer. We're hearing there. They're Silicon Valley firms. They think technology can solve everything. AI can't spot or can't make a decision necessarily between what is acceptable and what isn't.
No, especially if you consider the different types of cultures that might be involved in some of these exchanges as well. You know, there's a different attitude in some places than there is in others as to what might be explicit content, I suppose.
Yeah, and we're seeing, as we said at the beginning, pressure from politicians. We're seeing world leaders meeting in Sicily right now, and one of the topics they're discussing is how you clamp down on extremist content. But what may count as extremist content in one country won't apply in another. Do you think that the social networks are set up to deal with this? Because they've kind of seen themselves as global companies almost above the law up until now, haven't they?
As much as they might have set out with a different intention, it was a bit naive of them to think that they would embark on an internet business and then not have to deal with these kinds of problems at some point.
Samantha Smith from the BBC Tech Desk. You and I work in a media organisation where there are lots of set rules. Social networks are finding that applies to them too.
Absolutely. It's one of those things where when you've got the rules set out in front of you, it's a lot easier than having to come to it and make them up as you go along, which is kind of where they're finding themselves now. If there were editorial guidelines, such as the ones we have to stick to, it would be a lot easier for them. And I think they're learning this the hard way.
Does Computer Weekly need moderators on its forums?
We do get a couple of peculiar comments. We mostly leave the discussion open. I think, you know, the target audience isn't necessarily that ripe for needing that much moderation, luckily.
You've got a very civilised readership, I can tell you, which... Yeah, most social media firms perhaps not always have. We must move on. Let's have a look at some of the week's other big tech stories with Samantha Smith. Now, net neutrality, that's been a source of great controversy in the United States. We've talked about it a lot on the programme. But there's been a move to scrap that principle, and it's been greeted with enthusiasm by thousands of people. Or have I got that wrong?
Well, kind of, possibly. The Federal Communications Commission have been taking comments from the public on their plans to revoke net neutrality since the end of April. They've had almost 2.8 million comments so far, but it looks like as many as 500,000 of those comments have actually been posted by bots. And the bots seem to be quite strongly in favour of ditching net neutrality.
Right.
That's been sort of mulling around in the background. But this week, it turns out that a campaign group called Fight for the Future have had to write to the FCC on behalf of at least 14 people and potentially an awful lot more, who say that their names and addresses have been used without their permission to post some of these spam comments. Fight for the Future says that they've also heard that in some cases, comments have been posted by people who couldn't have posted them because they were dead. They want the fake comments removed from the FCC consultation. They also want an investigation into where the details being used to post these comments has come from, because they all look fairly genuine. The FCC hasn't commented directly on any of this, and they've said previously that when it comes to consultations and comments, they err on the side of inclusion. So if a comment doesn't look like it's particular, if a comment doesn't look obviously fake, it will stay up. So if Daffy Duck posted, for example, that entry would not be considered.
Daffy Duck doesn't have the right to a view on net neutrality.
Apparently not. He doesn't have a postal address and they can't prove that it's really him. But if it seems to be from a genuine person, then the comment will be left to stand.
Just the latest in the sort of fake news and fake comment tidal wave apparently sweeping the internet at the moment. Another story, another victory for the Google DeepMind AI program AlphaGo in the ancient Chinese game of Go. Who's it beaten this time?
I hope I get his name right here. He's the world's number one human Go player and he's called Ku Jie. He lost the second of three scheduled games against the AI yesterday. His first game was on Tuesday and he lost that match by just half a point. He's called AlphaGo the god of Go players.
I think AI definitely winning. One more story. The tennis superstar Serena Williams has joined the board of a tech company. Which one and why?
Yeah, she's joined the board of SurveyMonkey and she says that she's joined partly because she wants to tackle the issue of the lack of diversity in the technology industry. She hasn't said how she's planning to do that, but the suggestion is that simply by being there, she'll be able to help push SurveyMonkey and other tech companies in the right direction. That sentiment's been backed up by SurveyMonkey chief executive Xander Lurie, who said that having her and other change agents around the table will help to open their eyes.
Claire McDonald, briefly, there's quite a long way to go on diversity, particularly in Silicon Valley and in the London tech industry too.
Yeah, there absolutely is. And as much as there was a study, I think it was by a Leeds University Business School, that said that having one woman on a board can reduce the risk of bankruptcy for that company by 20%. So it's obviously there. As a business case for having more women on boards and in senior roles in companies. As to whether one woman joining one board in one company in Silicon Valley is actually going to start shifting the dial, I'm not sure. It's obviously a very public act, but she has no plans that we can see yet.
As you said, there's a mixed record in celebrities appearing on as representatives of technology companies. You're listening to Tech 10 on the BBC World Service with Rory Catlin-Jones. In a moment, is there really a demand for a phone that isn't that smart? Now, it seems every week we hear a new doom-laden prediction about the impact of robots and other forms of automation on jobs. But are we looking at this the wrong way? Too inclined to hang on to the world of work as it is today? Too unimaginative about how it could be transformed for the better by technology? That's the view of Riel Miller, who rejoices in the wonderful title of Head of Foresight at UNESCO. For many years, he's been paid to think about the future. When I caught up with him at the InnoRobo Robot Fair in Paris, he told me that thinking differently about the future could change the way the world works today.
When you project a future where you're all going to work in coal mines forever, you see the future in one way and you see the present in one way. When you see a future where robots do the mining and you have to do something else, it means you see the present in a different way. What I find very positive, but also I understand frightening, is that when things happen, they could be political, they could be technological, they change our idea of the future. By changing the idea of the future, we change what we see in the present.
It's not just about a different future, though. It is a scary future, and for a certain section of the population, you think of lorry drivers, you think of people in simple clerical jobs, they're looking at a future where they don't have a job.
I think that they're right to be concerned if we don't have ways of taking into account the needs of our society. In other words, if we think we don't have to care for people, if we think we don't have to educate people, if we think we don't have to take care of the environment and change the way we relate to the earth, then it might be true that there's nothing for them to do and no way for them to ever earn a living. But if we think of the past where we've seen jobs replaced by technologies and new organizational systems, we've seen always that human need and human capacity adapts and generates new ways of using our capacity to create value. And that's the critical thing. What's valuable? What's meaningful in this society? And everyone from a lorry driver to a professor, a prime minister to a school teacher wants to find meaning and value in their lives. And it's not something that's simply associated with doing what they happen to do now, because that is what's available. It can also be what they do in the future, because they invent, create, interdependently a better and different world.
We're just standing here, a robot has just walked past. It is a very fast-changing world. Do you see us able to adapt to our relationship with these machines? Because there is a lot of that anxiety.
I look to the generation that came out of the Second World War, for instance, where female labor force participation changed dramatically and changed the power structures in our society. I wonder if the change that we're experiencing today is as fast or as dramatic as the experiences they had then. In other words, I'm very suspect of our hubris of the now, which is, oh, because it's happening to me, it must be the most important, the fastest, the biggest, the bestest, the worstest. It's something that we need to be able to stand back from to understand that we live in a complex, emergent reality. We can't change that. My grandmother was scared of our car. Who here is scared of a car today? I think cars in some ways are like the lions of the past, because people get killed by them, right? It defies in some ways my sense of our intelligence, that we should be afraid of our own tools. Look, we've invented things which could destroy the species, the atomic bomb. Does that lead to the conclusion that we shouldn't inquire and try and understand the world, even if it might kill us? I think not, because we prefer to live that way. We prefer to live by understanding, by exploring, by inventing, by seeking meaning. And if we didn't, I don't think we'd be human, but life would also be very unpleasant because you'd be in a prison of your own mental creation.
Riel Miller from UNESCO with an optimistic view of the future of technology. Claire McDonald from Computer Weekly. Are you that optimistic? What do the figures show us about the threat to our jobs from the robots?
There seems to be this attitude that robots and automation that definitely will have an impact on specific kinds of jobs, and it might unfortunately be an impact on the people that maybe need these jobs most, and there needs to be an emphasis on education in the future to make sure that people have those sort of emotional intelligence and soft skills that might be needed for jobs that can't be automated in the future.
But we're always hearing about these white-collar jobs that will now be affected, but isn't actually there growing evidence that we'll be working alongside the robots? Maybe they'll take the boring bits of our jobs away, but leave us with the exciting things like radio presentation and so on.
There is speculation that the jobs that will be created in the future will be alongside robots, and that we'll have a better lifestyle, and it will all be really happy, and we'll have job titles like Chief Thought Officer or something like that, you know, and we'll be able to live a happier life where we won't be bored. But there are a lot of people who think that we'll have to work longer because we'll enjoy work more, if that makes sense.
That kind of makes sense. I'm staying on the optimistic side. I'm going to be the chief thought officer of Tech Tent. Now, if there's one technology that defines the last decade, it's the smartphone, now in the hands of more than a billion people around the world. So why would you want to go back to a time when a mobile phone was little more than talking and texting? This week, the Nokia 3310, a new version of an iconic phone, went on sale, pitched at people who want just a very basic device. But is this just a retro stunt to try to revive the Nokia brand? I set off to find out. Well, I've left the office without my smartphone. I feel a bit naked. All I've got with me is a Nokia 3310 that I've been lent, and I'm just trying to work out how I get to the address. Is there a mapping service on here? Doesn't seem to be. One good thing, the battery isn't going to run out. Well, I've got to the store where they've got this slightly strange stunt where they're going to start selling the 3310 at 10:33 in just a few minutes. And in the window, they've got a giant version of the phone with a screen on it, which is actually advertising a Samsung smartphone, the latest smartphone. So what's the need for this slightly less, in fact, you might say, rather dumb phone? Let's head inside and find out.
Simon Dornan, Car Phone Warehouse. It's all about mindfulness nowadays, isn't it, Rory? People want to get back to how it used to be and make a break from being connected to their phone all the time. There's a time right now when people want to get a bit retro, want to be reminded they can disconnect, but still be able to be got hold of in an emergency. So they just want a phone they can talk on and text on and do the basics to remind them what it used to be like.
Now, there are two other Nokia smartphones going on sale very shortly.
Yeah.
Won't this actually distract from them?
Not at all. I think the point of the 3310 and the whole retro nature of it is remind people what a great brand Nokia is, was, remind them what they thought was fantastic about their old Nokia, and then kind of pave the way for this, the return of Nokia as a brand on some fantastic range of smartphones.
Isn't it going to make people think, oh, Nokia makes old-fashioned phones? It's not going to make them think Nokia makes the latest phones.
Not at all. Do you know what? The response to this phone has been unbelievable. You were at Barcelona. Now, this is the most talked-about handset out of Barcelona.
You're the first customer.
Yes, I am the first one.
Why do you want this phone? It doesn't do anything.
This is a history. This is an amazing phone, so why not?
I can see in your hand you've got a smartphone.
This is my, office stuff. So,
you're going to give that up and just have a phone that does nothing?
No, I just want to change it, so that's why I'm here.
Will you use it for going on the internet?
Just to have a snake. Game snake, yeah?
Just to play snake?
Yes.
Okay.
That's right. I love it.
I want something that's got a good track record, something that will be reliable, and again, something very, very basic.
You're not going to be Snapchatting then?
No. The kind of job I used to do, I was a debt collector. The last thing I want to do is to put my face out there.
So you prefer the simple life?
I try to. I believe in the KISS principle. Keep it simple, stupid.
So they're not exactly queuing out the doors, but it does appear to be proving a hit, this retro phone, with a nostalgic crowd who wants something simple. Whether it's promoting Nokia as a reborn brand of the future, well, I'm not so sure. Well, I tried to live with that phone, the Nokia 3310, for a few hours the other day without my smartphone, and I found it pretty difficult. I'm addicted. Claire McDonald, are you addicted to your smartphone? Could you live with something a lot simpler?
Probably not anymore. I was pretty late to the smartphone game. I didn't get one for years after everybody else already had one because I didn't see the point. Now, I don't think that I could live without my phone.
You just need to be online all the time.
It seems that way, even though when you think about it, you're not actually doing anything useful, yeah.
So, Samantha Smith, I mean, the whole point of this is a PR gimmick, isn't it? It's supposed to be promoting the Nokia brand. They're really interested in promoting their high-end Android smartphones. But is anybody talking about them?
No. We were talking earlier and there are two, three other, I don't even know how many other new smartphones there are. They've got a few new really good high-end smartphones coming out and we're sat talking about the one that harks back to 20-odd years ago.
I mean, it's worked in one way because we wouldn't be talking about Nokia but for this, but it's a pretty high-risk PR strategy, isn't it?
It is, and I'm not sure having Snake back makes up for being able to do everything else that we can do these days online.
Briefly, you're not going to be giving up your smartphone and going back to a simpler life then?
No, no. Not.
We couldn't do our jobs without that kind of constant connectivity, whether or not it's good for us. We've run out of time again. Thanks to my special guest, Claire McDonald of Computer Weekly. Thanks to Samantha Smith from the BBC Technology Desk. Read all of her stories and mine at bbc.com/technology. Don't forget to tell all of your friends to download our podcast and join us again in the Tech Tent at the same time next week. Before you go, if you're enjoying Tech Tent, then allow me to recommend another offering from the BBC World Service. Just one question first. Do you eat? Well, if you answered yes, then this podcast is for you. The food chain is for farmers, foodies and fellow diners. Go to bbc.com/foodchain to find out more.